Yeah, we'll kill Vio. We don't need it. Might distract us anyway. You're too good looking.
I know. That is the problem I have. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am the captain of this ship, the SS Pre-Accident Podcast, and I'm going to take you on a psychological trip through the history of high reliability and new safety differently. Nah, that wasn't that good. Not really. No. Now we're going to have a podcast just like we always do, and I'm glad you're here, and I hope everything's going well. It is probably, towards the end of the shortest month of the year, so it flies by, as you know, and things are remarkable, and I should probably remark on them, because that's why things are remarkable. You know that I'm on this big quest to find the good in everybody, and I'm wondering if it's actually the wrong thing to do. I mean, I'm just talking out loud here. I don't have any theory. But in my zeal to find the good in everybody, I'm getting into trouble. I almost got kicked off a plane by the police the other day. I'm not kidding. I get on a plane. I don't want to say the name of the airline, but it's Southwest Airlines. And there's a big delay getting out of Dallas because the jet bridge won't work. Even though I don't really understand why they say that, because I just watched them unload an entire plane full of people, but then now the jet bridge doesn't work. And so they say, we're not going to load it because we think it's a safety problem. Well, it's not a safety problem. It's a maintenance problem. And clearly, if you unload the entire plane, then that sort of says it's not a safety problem, unless they put everybody's life at risk to get them off the plane and saved my life because my life was more valuable than the 120 people that didn't. Anyway, long story short, I hate it when they convolute. There's two things I hate. I hate it when they convolute operational problems and call them safety problems in order to justify the delay. The other thing I hate are false choices. So when the airline says, and they actually said this to me because I went up and said, "What, you know, what's the story? No one's talking to us. At least tell us what's going on." And they said, "Sir, would you rather be on time or be safe?" Which is a question they ask a lot. Would you rather be on time or be safe? Well, here's my answer. I actually bought a ticket for both. It's not a choice, one or the other. I don't give up on-time performance in order to get safety performance, nor do I give up safety in order to be on time. I mean, that's not how the world works, but that's kind of what they've drifted over time to say. And I realize that they tell us this because I think they think it's a more palatable answer for the passenger to hear. And I do think it sort of takes away our ability as a passenger to complain or say, you know, this is not acceptable, or how can you be this late? This is your main airport and there's a million jetways here. How could this be this big of a problem? Neither here nor there. That's kind of what started the trip. But then I get on the plane after they move it, you know, to the complete other side of the airport, and we all trudge over there, and then they have a little truck that they pull the plane with, and we all get on the plane. And then we all board dutifully and quite nicely, and then they're counting how many passengers, and they count one time, and they come back and say, "I counted all the empty seats, but I can't get the numbers to work out. I'm kind of sitting up front so I can hear all this." So the other flight attendant says, "Well, let me count." And so they walk back there and they count, and they come back and they said, "Yeah, you're right. It doesn't work out." And then the third flight attendant says, "Well, I'll go." And they come back and say, yeah, something's wrong. So I'll go get the gate agent. And then one flight attendant says, "Well, why don't you count the full seats?" So they count the full seats and they came back and said, "Well, now the full seats are right. But that can't be, because the empty seats can't be wrong and the full seats be right." And I'm listening to all this. And then another person comes, the gate agent comes in, and they say, "Well, let me count." And they count, and then they can't count. And they come back to the front and they say, "The empty seats don't count." And they said, "Well, try the full ones." So now we're on five times counting this. This is the fifth time they've counted this. And so I pushed the little flight attendant button, and the flight attendant says, "Yes, can I help you?" And I said, "Are we going to leave today? Because now we're 2 hours late." And the flight attendant says, "Sir, this is a pretty serious safety problem." Well, I've already sort of told you how I feel about that. And I said, "No, I don't think it is a safety problem. I actually think it's an accounting problem." And she said, "Sir, would you rather be safe or on time?" And I said, "I don't think it's a choice." And she spun around and went up to the cockpit, to the flight deck, I believe is what they call it, and talked to the pilot. I'm watching all this. And then they both walk out, and then pretty soon a policeman comes in and says to me, "Is there a problem here, sir?" And I said, "Yeah, no one seems to be able to count to 124. And he said, "I'm going to pull you off this flight because you can't give the flight attendant a hard time. We've got to pull you off." And I thought, well, this is it. This is how it'll end, at least this trip. And man, much to my surprise, and I was pretty surprised by this, the other passengers came to my defense. I think they were maybe as frustrated, if not maybe even a little more frustrated than I was, and said, he didn't do anything. The problem is they've counted this 5 or 6 times. He just asked them when we're going to leave, and they responded kind of negatively. And so the policeman, God bless him, said, "Okay, no problem at all." He said, "But I would hang a little low on this flight." And I said, "Yeah, I think that's a good idea." And he walked off the plane, and then pretty soon they finally got the count right. You know, they ended up counting the actual number of people that are on the plane and not the number of empty seats. That seemed to make the biggest difference. And then they shut the door, and we took off. And it was kind of a cold flight, I must be honest with you. I didn't get a lot of attention. Although that said, I didn't get a lot of attention either positively or negatively, which is probably a benefit. And we flew to wherever we were flying, and I got off the plane. But it was a really interesting problem. And I wondered about it a lot. We're sort of in a position where I think when we use safety issues to explain human resources failures or performance management failures or salary issues or social fairness issues, we're probably doing exactly the same thing that the airline does. And so it's a pretty good lesson to me. And what's crazy is, remember, my theme is to see good in everything, but I don't know. I'll give you full reports on it, but that's the little picture of my life, at least thus far, so far. Today's podcast is pretty interesting. I think you're going to like it. It's a guy named Scott Filmon, F-I-L-L-M-O-N, Filmon. And Scott is a kind of a renaissance guy around investigations, and he holds no set place in the investigation world. He looks at lots of IT problems. He looks at lots of process problems. He looks at lots of quality problems, and he looks at a lot of safety problems. And we were talking, and he said, "You know, let's do a podcast." And so I said, "Well, let's do a podcast. That's a great idea." And so I talked to Scott a little bit about investigations, and I think you guys will like it, because in many ways he's not from the safety world, and so you're going to hear some old investigation talk, but it's really very interestingly woven with kind of new view. And it's that crossover that I think is really valuable. And there's always great interest in investigation stuff. And so I thought this is probably a pretty good podcast to do. So let's get into it. I think it's worth getting into. Without much further ado, this is Scott Filmon on investigations of all sizes, shapes, and colors.
It's been an interesting several years. You know, about 5 years ago, I kind of decided to expand my reach a little bit. I spent some time, you know, working with manufacturing organizations, more so around the software industry, and kind of started around Y2K, you know, trying to help them get onto the new 4-digit year platforms. And I was doing a lot of problem analysis and trying to help businesses be more efficient with their information systems. And that kind of came about because, you know, my background related to our nuclear experiences with both commercial nuclear power and the weapons, you know, industry across DOE, you know, kind of gives me that analytical kind of mindset, you know. So I got pulled into these manufacturing organizations trying to do better at what they do using, you know, Six Sigma and Kaizen and all those fun tools. And I started blending, you know, my background related to problem analysis and more specifically incident investigations, and using structured things such as 5 whys and event and conditional factors analysis and fault tree analysis. And it was an interesting how those things tied to how we investigate incidents, you know, whether those be safety related or process related, all seem to apply in the world of computing, software development, and technology. So it, with that said, you know, about 5 years ago, I realized, you know, all these things cross so many platforms. And if you just take logical approaches to analyzing problems, whether they, again, be generated from an event, whether that be a safety event or a process problem, you know, related to manufacturing or human factors, it all can come back together, not only one to help you identify what went wrong, but more importantly, how do I fix it? You know, how do I make my organization better so that things don't come back, you know, because that seems to be the common issue. You know, problems come back. And, you know, we've been working really well with a couple of tools that we put together to consolidate how to investigate, you know, incidents from a very process forensic kind of view, and turn that into solutions, you know, that help prevent recurrence.
So why do you think we got to a point where we were so bad at doing investigations? And maybe I should own that a little. Why do you think we devalue the analysis part of an investigation?
You know, it's a great question, and I still ask myself how we fell there. But a lot of times, and you know, it feels like to me that there complacency kind of fell in. I watched for many years organizations just kind of take tools and just say, hey, let's apply this, you know. And I think back to the old quality tools that were floating around in the 90s, you know, and they all took different names, you know, TQM. And again, not to diminish them, but we started applying things to the checked boxes. And if we checked the boxes, then obviously we were fine. We've passed the test, you know, and we got too regulatory driven by, well, if I've met the regulation, then obviously I'm doing well here, you know. Saw that huge in the Department of Energy, where we got real regulatory focused on just meet the requirements of this order. And if you've done it, then you're good to go. Regardless of what went wrong, hey, we met the order. And I heard that excuse too many times. And I see it in the private sector as well, where, you know, folks look to check a box. But that doesn't mean you're doing well. It doesn't mean you're being safe. You know, it just means, you know, you put up the signs, if you will.
My theory is, and tell me if I'm wrong, that it's much sexier to fix problems than it is to analyze problems.
Yeah, you know, it's a great theory, Todd. I think you're dead on. And a lot of times people like to get that, you know, bang for the buck. Hey, look what we did. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying, you know, hanging the signs. You know, it's just showing, illustrating, you know, that we're doing things and not, you know, from a superficial point of view, if you will. Here's an interesting characterization. And one of the things that I had a really great privilege of doing is working with the transportation industry. I spent many years, and I still work with them, in the trucking side of the game for the federal agents who oversee the trucking industry. And we, for years, we couldn't understand how we could get the roadside safety performance to be improved, because the trucking industry was, you know, meeting the regulations, and the environment that was for the agents who were overseeing them, both at the federal level and the state level, the state troopers, you know, they had a book, you know, the CFRs that said, you must do this. And the trucking companies could illustrate, hey, we did our logs, and, you know, we did our qualification checks, and we hired meeting these requirements, and we do medical, you know, analysis and all that for diabetes, on and on and on. But yet people were still having crashes. People were still, you know, violating the rules. And so what we did was we, you know, some brilliant people got together. I'm not going to say I'm one of them, but I was there. We created this thing called the safety management cycle. which is a really neat tool that looks at six major areas.
Okay, tell me more about that. I'm curious. Yeah, I'm really curious about that.
Yeah, it's a really cool tool. And again, some great folks got together and put their heads and said, hey, let's stop and think about how safety, and we came up with a cycle that said, look, you have to start out by first identifying what your issues are. What are all the things that you need to pay attention to, right? And then once you understood, whether that be regulatory policy, procedures, or just best practice, all driven by safety, you know, then know what your strengths and weaknesses are and start off with this. Number one, establish good policies and procedures to guide that, to oversee it and set your boundaries. Once you've done that, then define the roles and responsibilities of your organization. Once you knew that you had roles and responsibilities defined, then you did qualification and hiring. You hired the right people with the right qualifications and then provided them, number four, with the training that necessary to get their job done. Establish strong communication lines to ensure that there's some vision, you know, of this, you know, this action. Create a system, this is number five, of monitoring and tracking, so that you could, one, measure your performance, know that you're meeting your goals. But the best element of this was the last one. It's called meaningful action. And that was our sixth piece of the cycle. And the idea behind that was, all of this said, everything had to be done with some meaningful action in place, which basically says to the organization, don't just do this because, one, you're checking the box. Two, a regulatory requirement says you do. You do it because it means something to you as an organization. Define how it changes you. How does it make you better, or how does it make you weaker? And if it makes you weaker, get back in the cycle and redefine it. And the idea behind it was, the concept is about self-measurement. Define your rules so that you can put this in place. And what this all is, this is the first piece of this incident management series that I've put together. This is what you do to make sure that you're doing the preventive action to reduce incident potentials, right? And it's applying this safety management cycle. Once you've done that, here's the reality of life. We are going to have something go wrong, right? Incidents happen. Whether things reach outside my control because it exceeded a boundary, or my systems just weren't in place to manage it. So the second piece of my series is all about what we've coined as forensic incident response. And it's responding to the event as it's happening with the forensic approach of investigation. Now, we kind of decided to coin the concept of forensic because there's so much popularity behind things like CSI and these TV shows, you know, NCIS that talk about how to collect evidence, reconstruct the incident, you know, look for deviations from the normal, walk through and stage the environment so that you can analyze it properly. Because I'll tell you, one of the things that I learned the most about my background coming from root cause analysis and incident investigation was that by the time I reached the point of I'm going to go try to figure out what happened, almost all the evidence behind the event was gone, you know, because the organization's got to need to get ready, you know, get back to business, you know. So the scene gets cleaned, you know, interview, you know, subjects or witnesses are back to their jobs and, you know, and so on. And nobody once stopped at the moment in time and took a photograph, you know, of the scene immediately after it happened. Nobody once captured all of the witnesses and subjects nearby and got them to give them a statement, so that they can analyze it later and compare it to the, you know, to the interviews that you took, you know, and so on. So this concept of forensic response is really critical to making sure that when you actually at the end do incident, you know, analysis, whether it be through structured root cause or some kind of, you know, recreation, that you had the ability to do that from those evidence collection.
Well, I'd push on you a little and fight back with me for sure. But
hey, let's go.
Here we go. Ready? Go. I spend an awful lot of time telling investigators that they're not policemen. That the purpose of an investigation, near as I can see it, is for the organization to learn and improve. And I think we're fine on that. I mean, I think we agree on that, right?
Yeah. Okay, I concur with you, but let's first we gotta do is take away the image of the policeman, right?
Right.
Too often we create an image of a policeman.
Are angels getting their wings in your office?
You know, that is exactly what's happening.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. Now, take away the image of the policeman. Go ahead.
So you have to, because, see, we too often see an image of a policeman of writing you a ticket, you know, cuffing someone and put them in, you know, taking them away. You know, and it's about, you know, enforcing rules. That's not what I'm talking about. Because, see, there's this other – the other role of our law enforcement is trying to help bring us back to normal when things go wrong.
So the fear is the investigation is going to lead to a bad outcome, like a punishment or – some kind of blaming or some kind of you know, additional burden on the employees or workers.
But you know, that fear is only going to come if the organization is actually doing that. You know, I think we should hope that we're in a society today where, you know, retaliation is never going to solve the problem. We all have to, you know, recognize that, you know, for problems to go away, whether they be driven by process or, again, or driven by just sheer, you know, event, you know, process, you know, how an event unfolds that, you know, leaves our boundaries. It isn't about finding fault and who did it. It's how can we stop this from happening again?
So are you telling me that revenge is not a governance policy?
I sure hope not. You know, I mean, I hope we're beyond it, you know.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, I'm just looking at the world today. That's all I'm saying. I'm just looking at the world today.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, man. And I wish I could tell you that I could tell you that it's gone. But every once in a while, I still stumble onto it where, you know, when I see things, when I ask organizations why they're still having some issues, and you really can get true, you know, heartfelt responses from all levels of staff, you'll hear that fear is still there. The fear of one, retaliation, we're not, you know, revenge is a strong word, or just, you know, I'm going to solve this problem by removing the individual. And that's not it. You know, I think, Todd, you know, once you gave me a life-changing word, and it was because I was down the path of trying to find out why something happened. And I could, you know, your temperature rose as you said, no, Scott, it's how. Focus on how. And once you do that, then you'll stop thinking about, again, why, and pointing the fingers at who. It isn't about that. It's how does this happen, and how do we let things lose our control? And if everyone recognizes they have some ownership to it, you know, at all levels, that they have some ownership to why things went wrong, then they recognize, wait, not why, how, I must have something I can fix too. Shared responsibility, you know, that takes away the need for retaliation.
What tips would you give investigators? What tip would you give somebody, hints or top tips or lessons learned would you give to investigators on doing this kind of forensics learning?
Well, you know, I tell you that one of the things I tell the folks I teach is a couple of different things. One, I think it's critical that you do open your mind then and recognize that, one, you don't know everything. And in fact, if you can set aside your own knowledge base and put that bias beside you and walk in with this attitude of the child who doesn't know anything, and if you put yourself in that mindset as you start the investigation, you know, and start your analysis, then you're going to listen. You're going to hear things better.
What's a good investigation look like?
So, you know, a good investigation to me, Todd, is every investigation must start off with a recreation of the event. I personally use, you know, the foundation principles of what's called the event and conditional factors analysis plus technique. That technique is all about just visually creating from the moment of the event starts. That doesn't always mean when you hear the bang, but whatever started that proverbial snowball or roll down the hill, you know, all the way to the point where we're back to stable. And if I can recreate that visually, you know, through a flow charting system so that all the the twining factors of the conditions that occurred, the actual events themselves with all the actors and the timestamps and anything, the things that didn't happen that should have are all defined. That's critical. Because once you can understand the event, put yourself in the shoes of the performers, the actors engaged, then you can start to understand the perspectives of the influence of the environment and the culture, you know, of the organization as this event unfolded.
How long should an investigation take?
Boy, that one's almost impossible to put a time on, Todd. You know, sometimes, you know, you can do things in a short period of time if you've got all the pieces in front of you. But I find nothing can be done in less than a week, and everything should be able, could be done within 30 days, depending on the complexity. You know, I'm not going to get, you know, even compared to something like a large event like, you know, Titanic sinking into the water, or, an airplane falling out of the sky. Those could take much longer because sometimes the pieces aren't there anymore, you know, but most investigations can fall in that, you know, 1 week to 3 week, 4 week concept.
What about the idea of investigating success?
You know, that's exactly great point, Todd. That's what the first part of my series talks about, too. I think what you always have to do is look at what you do well, because this is one of the things I like to do, too, in my in my analysis phase falling incident. I didn't tell you my four-letter word that I use, because a lot of folks cringe, but I do use MORT, the Management Oversight and Risk Tree, at times, especially in the nuclear community, the power facilities. We've been applying MORT across the board at the in the regulatory side of the game. What's nice about using a system like MORT is it does look at when you do well. And it, you know, it's designed for you to identify when organizations do something right, because you have to look at, if you can do something well, then why can't you do that well with the thing that you failed at? And I like to illustrate to some folks, take a look at what you're doing right. Find those key things. What drives it, and apply that across the board, you know, to learn from your successes and apply that to where areas of weakness. And that's what you need to be doing in the beginning. And I think you catched it that well in your book on, you know, pre-accident investigations. And that is to always be looking forward, to try to identify things where you could stumble and fix them before they do, by looking at what you do well and applying it there.
It's kind of,
I think that's smart. That's a smart advice.
It's kind of interesting because, I always have believed that the least interesting part of an event is what happened. So the actual consequence of the event is not very interesting. It's everything mm-hmm. that led up to the event.
You got that right.
And then every sort of thing that happened after the event. So all the context before, and then all the mm-hmm. retrospect after, and those two things make for a really interesting view of the world.
Exactly. And it's that's the challenge, and that's that I have to be ever vigilant, you know, ever vigilant to look for where are my holes, and are they lining up? Can I close them? And if I can't, can I realign them? You know, and that's the key to doing good, you know, upfront analysis, and you know, making sure that systems in place are still working the way I designed them.
Do you have a web page or anything? How do people contact you?
Email is always the best way to find me, at scott@filmon.com.
That was a nice little conversation with Scott, don't you think? It's fun. It's all voices matter, and with investigations, I really am pretty open to bringing people on who do investigations that want to talk about doing investigations. And Scott's got lots to tell us. To me, the interesting thing about Scott, other than he's a really fun guy and hilarious and an amazing, amazing instructor, is that he really uses tools across discipline very easily. In fact, he's a kind of a leader in this thinking, has been doing it a really long time. Any tool that makes sense out of the IT industry that he can use to look at an operational upset, no problem at all, or vice versa. When he's doing IT investigations, which is kind of what he does the majority of, then he can look right across the street at all the tools he's used out of the safety world, out of the reliability world, and pop those in. And his background in transportation has really given him a rich depth of knowledge and experience around investigations. It was a good podcast. I know you learned a lot. That's important. It's going great. As always, you know, pick somebody who you think would really benefit from listening to this podcast and invite that one person to listen. It's pretty easy to do, and you can do it. Just think of one person that probably doesn't even know these podcasts are out there. Even better, think of somebody who should be on this that's really got something to say, got some depth and experience, and we find entertaining. Really don't limit it to depth and experience if they're entertaining. They're always open to a conversation then. Either way, let's get them on the podcast and make it happen. I think that's a pretty good closer for today. I think we've done enough work. It's time to get back in there and you know, step in the poop and get work done. So here we go. That's what we'll do. I hope everybody gets what they need. That's pretty important to me. That's a big push for this year in my quest to find goodness everywhere. And as always, I hope you learned something today. I bet you did. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.